screens counting. Welcome to Base by Base, the papercast that brings genomics to you wherever you are. Thanks for listening, and don't forget to follow and rate us in your podcast app. Now, to start off today, I really want you to just, you know, imagine the sheer physical scale of what happens during human development.
Oh, yeah. It's staggering when you actually break it down.
Right. Like, from the very moment of conception, you have this single cell, and it has to divide and then divide again, ultimately forming the trillions of cells that make up an entire human body.
Trillions! It's almost hard to wrap your head around.
Exactly. And every single time one of those cells divides, it has to flawlessly copy an immense, staggering amount of genetic material. We're talking 3 billion base pairs.
Yeah, per cell division.
It's this microscopic, high-space biological operation running at breakneck speed. But what happens when the very scaffolding of that cellular copying machine is inherently unstable from day one?
Well, it forces us to look at the fragility of life from a completely different angle. I mean, we're talking about a biological operation that must be absolutely precise to build a human being.
Yeah.
And yet we see how vulnerable the entire system is to the tiniest structural disruptions.
So imagine a microscopic wobble in a single structural protein, just one, and somehow that tiny instability ripples out to affect the entire growth of the human body.
But the whole system just, it scales down.
Right. We're talking about everything from the size of the brain to the basic metabolic function of the liver. It really makes you wonder how such an incredibly microscopic defect can dictate the macroscopic limits of a person's life and, well, in some cases, whether they survive at all.
Today, we celebrate the work of Deborah Tibbe, Kirsten Kutchis, and a massive global collaboration of clinicians and researchers who have advanced our understanding of the genetic foundations of human growth and development.
Yeah, and the research we're diving into today was published in 2026 in the American Journal of Human Genetics. It's really this brilliant masterclass in genetic sleuthing that connects a tiny cellular defect to a severe human condition known as microcephalic primordial dwarfism, or MPD.
To give you the clinical context here, microcephalic primordial dwarfism is a genetically heterogeneous condition.
Which means?
That simply means it isn't caused by just one single broken gene in the human population. Mutations in several different genes can actually lead to the same clinical destination.
Got it.
And it's characterized by extreme growth retardation that begins before birth, so intrauterine growth retardation, and continues throughout the patient's entire life.
And the microcephalic part of that refers to microcephaly, meaning the patients have a significantly smaller head and brain size compared to, you know, expected growth charts.
Which completely makes sense when you consider that brain development requires an explosion of rapid cell division.
Right.
So to understand why this global growth failure happens, we really have to look at the biological machinery responsible for copying DNA. And this machine is called the replicome.
The replicome.
Yeah. The replicome is this massive multi-protein complex that sits right at the replication fork.
And that's the exact spot where the DNA double helix is actively being unzipped, right? Mm-hmm. So both strands can be copied simultaneously.
Exactly. That's the replication fork.
So I was thinking about this. Mm-hmm. If the replicome is like a massive construction crew working to build a new skyscraper, the main character of our deep dive today, which is a gene called WBHD1, it basically codes for the central scaffolding holding the workers up.
That is a great way to picture it.
Right, because this protein, which is also known as AND1, is the structural hub. If you've ever seen a construction site where the scaffolding is wobbly or, I don't know, missing bolts, you know the actual builder.
The DNA polymerases.
Yeah, the polymerases, they just can't lay down the bricks properly. The whole project slows down, mistakes get made, or the entire structure just collapses.
And the WDHD1 protein specifically assembles what we call the pre-replicome complex. It physically stabilizes that replication fork as the DNA unzips.
Okay.
But beyond just holding the crew together, it also helps ensure that the newly copied sister chromatids, the identical copies of the chromosome, stay glued together until the cell is actually ready to divide. It's a primary guardian of genome integrity.
Which means if that scaffolding is fundamentally broken, the consequences for a developing embryo are going to be catastrophic.
Absolutely catastrophic.
But tracking down a defect in a single scaffolding protein across a global population sounds incredibly difficult. I mean, how did the research team actually pull this off?
It required an incredibly wide net. The team gathered genetic and clinical data from 17 subjects across 14 different families globally.
Wow, 14 families.
Yeah, and to find the root cause of their MPD, they utilized advanced genetic sequencing techniques. Specifically, they deployed both whole exome sequencing, or WES, and whole genome sequencing, or WGS.
Okay, let's break that down for a second. If you're hunting for a mutation, why do you need both the exome and the genome? Like, what's the difference?
Good question. The exome is just the protein coding region of your DNA, which actually makes up only about 1% to 2% of the entire genome.
Just 1% to 2%, that's it.
That's it. So whole exome sequencing is fantastic for catching blatant spelling errors directly inside the genes that build proteins, but sometimes the mutation isn't in the blueprint itself.
Where is it then?
It's in the deep, non-coding regions that regulate the gene or dictate how the RNA is spliced together. So when the exome sequencing comes up empty, or, you know, only finds one part of the puzzle, you have to run whole genome sequencing to sweep those vast non-coding spaces for hidden structural shifts.
So they cast this massive genetic net and pinpoint the exact spelling mistakes, these variants, in the WDHD1 gene.
Exactly.
But just finding a spelling mistake on a computer screen doesn't really tell you how the biological machine is actually breaking down inside a living human cell.
Right. It doesn't give you the mechanics. To see the mechanics of the disease, they had to create living cellular models. So they took tiny skin biopsies from the subjects and grew those skin cells, which are known as fibroblasts, in the lab.
Okay. So now they have living tissue.
Yes. A renewable source of living tissue harboring the exact genetic variants of the patients. And then they could probe and stress test those cells under the microscope.
And they used flow cytometry for that, right? To see where these cells were stalling out during the cell cycle.
Yeah, and they found they were struggling to even transition from the G1 growth phase into the S phase to start copying their DNA.
But the part of their methodology that absolutely fascinated me was the DNA fiber assay. I mean, it's incredible that scientists can literally tag and measure the physical speed of a cellular copying machine in real time.
It is very cool.
How does that molecular speed trap actually work?
They literally feed the dividing cells special building blocks of DNA that are tagged with fluorescent colors.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, so first, they pulse the cells with a red fluorescent tag called CLDU for exactly 30 minutes. The working replisomes incorporate this red tag into the new DNA.
Okay.
Then they wash that out and switch to a green tag called IDU for another 30 minutes.
So the newly built DNA strand is physically glowing red, followed immediately by a segment glowing green.
You got it. And when they extract that DNA, stretch it out physically on a glass slide, and look at it under a fluorescence microscope, they see these microscopic red and green tracks.
That's amazing.
By measuring the physical length of those colored tracks, they can calculate exactly how fast the replisome was moving during that hour.
But they didn't just measure the baseline speed either. They threw a wrench in the gears, right?
They did. They used a chemical called hydroxyurea to artificially stall the replication forks.
What does that do?
Hydroxyurea essentially depletes the cell of the raw nucleotides it needs to build DNA.
Ah, so the construction site runs out of bricks.
Exactly. This allows researchers to see how the mutant cells handle sudden, severe replication stress, and, crucially, whether they have the stability to restart the copying process once the stress is removed and the raw materials are returned.
Okay, so you have these patient cells in the lab running through the flow cytometer and the molecular speed traps. What did the data actually show, and how did it map onto the clinical reality of the 17 subjects?
Well, the clinical spectrum is heartbreakingly broad. They broke the patients down into three distinct severity groups.
Group one, right?
Yes, group one consisted of four fetuses with very severe malformations affecting the heart and the brain. The replicative stress was so profound that it led to early lethality before birth. They simply could not generate enough healthy cells to form viable organs.
That's so sad. And then you have group two, which included six neonates who survived to term but passed away shortly after birth. And the striking detail that jumped out at me is that four of those neonates suffered from acute liver failure.
We will definitely circle back to the liver because it is a fascinating mechanical connection.
Yeah, definitely.
But finally, you have group three, which comprised seven living children and teens, ranging in age from 3 to 16 years old.
Okay, so a wide range.
Right, and these individuals presented with the classic markers of microcephalic primordial dwarfism. So, extreme growth restriction, high-pitched voices, feeding difficulties, and delayed motor and speech development.
So you have severe prenatal lethality on one end, and living 16-year-olds on the other. What was driving this spectrum of disease at the microscopic level?
The genetic analysis revealed 12 different biallelic variants in the WDHD1 gene.
Biallelic meaning the patients inherited a mutation from both parents.
Right. And many of these variants caused what's called aberrant splicing.
Okay, what is that?
When a gene is transcribed into messenger RNA, the non-coding introns have to be spliced out, so the final blueprint is perfectly readable. It's like editing a film.
Okay, I can picture that.
Aberrant splicing means the cellular editing machinery made a mistake because of the mutation, crucial exons were skipped, or non-coding junk was left in the frame. Because of this botched editing, the researchers found that the actual levels of the WDHD1 scaffolding protein inside these patient cells plummeted down to just 15 to 20% of normal levels.
Okay, wait, stop right there. I have to push back on this 15% number.
Oh.
Yeah, because if the replisome is the fundamental copying machine for all of life, and the central scaffolding is running on just 15% capacity, how is there a living teenager to study? Shouldn't a fundamental failure in DNA replication just be completely incompatible with life?
If the protein were totally missing what we call a complete loss of function or null variant, you're absolutely right. It would be biologically impossible to survive. The embryo would arrest after just a few cell divisions.
Okay, so why didn't it?
Because these are what we call hypomorphic variants. The protein isn't totally absent, the aberrant splicing is leaky, or the mutated protein retains a tiny fraction of its function. That remaining 15 to 20% allows the cells to just barely scrape by. They survive, but they are operating under immense continuous stress.
They are limping along. And the DNA fiber assay proved exactly how badly they were limping, didn't it?
It did. The replication forks in the patient cells were significantly slowed down compared to healthy cells. The scaffolding was wobbly, so the polymerase builders had to work at a fraction of their normal pace.
Worse than just slowing down, the cells showed a massive increase in spontaneous DNA damage.
Yes, when the replication fork stalls or collapses because of that wobbly scaffolding, the physical DNA strand can snap, creating a double-strand break.
And the researchers track this using a cellular warning marker called gamma-H2AX, right?
Exactly. When DNA physically breaks, the cell tags the broken ends with this gamma-H2AX protein. The patient's cells were lit up with a significantly higher number of these glowing warning tags, proving their genome was fracturing under the stress of basic cell division.
And the architectural chaos didn't stop at the DNA level. The very structure of the nucleus, the biological vault that holds the genome, was heavily deformed.
Yeah, they looked at a protein called lamin B1, which forms the inner lining of the nuclear envelope.
And if you picture a healthy nucleus, it's a smooth, plump oval. But in these patient cells, the nuclei were multilobed. They looked like lumpy clouds. The envelopes were visibly wrinkled and collapsed.
They also documented premature sister chromatid separation.
Oh, right.
Remember how we established that WDHD1 helps keep the newly copied chromosomes glued together until division? In these patient cells, the chromosomes were splitting apart far too early. It's a total breakdown of genomic coordination.
They even found these things called micronuclei. Why are there little runaway compartments of DNA floating around outside the main nucleus?
It's the physical scar of genome instability. When a chromosome fractures under replicative stress, small fragments of broken DNA get left behind in the cytoplasm during cell division.
Like debris.
Exactly. And the cell, trying to protect itself, wraps a tiny separate nuclear membrane around that rogue fragment, creating a micronucleus. It acts like a quarantine zone.
So the wrinkled nuclear envelopes and these tiny quarantine bubbles are the cell desperately trying to manage the debris of its own shattered genome.
And the biology gets even wilder here. Recent studies suggest the cell doesn't just passively leave the micronucleus there. It actively and intentionally ruptures that tiny membrane.
Wait, why would it do that?
To expose the damaged DNA fragment to enzymes in the cytoplasm, known as nucleases, which then degrade and destroy the rogue DNA. The cell is purposefully popping a bubble of its own broken genome to clear out the trash.
That is absolutely incredible. It's engaging in localized self-destruction just to keep the rest of the cell viable.
Yeah.
So we have this microscopic war zone, slowed replication, shattered DNA glowing with warning tags, purposefully ruptured micronuclei. Let's connect this back to the clinical realities of the patients. I want to go back to group two.
The neonates?
Yes. Why did four of those neonates die from acute liver failure? What does the liver have to do with a DNA replication scaffolding protein?
Well, the liver is a highly unique and metabolically demanding organ. It constantly filters toxins and manages our metabolism. To grow and handle that stress, the liver requires an immense amount of DNA replication through a specialized process called polyploidization.
Polyploidization. Most cells in our body just have two copies of the genome, right? One from each parent.
Right. But liver cells, or hepatocytes, frequently duplicate their entire DNA without actually dividing into two cells.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, they just pack more DNA into the existing cell, resulting in hepatocytes with 4, 8, or even 16 copies of the genome. This allows them to massively ramp up their production of metabolic enzymes.
So the liver is essentially a biological stress test for the replicin. Every other organ is dividing normally, but the developing liver steps on the gas and forces the replicin to copy the genome over and over and over again.
And because these WDHD1 variants cause severe replicative stress even at baseline, the massive biological demand of liver polyploidization pushes these developing cells right past their breaking point.
They just can't keep up.
They accumulate too much DNA damage, the replication forks collapse entirely, and the organs simply cannot develop the cellular infrastructure it needs to sustain life. That mechanical bottleneck, beautifully and tragically, explains the acute liver failure observed in those specific neonates.
It's a stunning connection. A microscopic scaffolding wobble completely destroys the one organ that demands the most heavy lifting.
Yeah, it really is.
And the broader implication of this paper is that WDHD1 is now firmly established as a crucial gene for human growth. The authors note that the clinical presentation overlaps heavily with other genes known to cause microcephalic primordial dwarfism, like Donson and TRAPE.
They do. They all code for different components of the DNA replication machinery. It paints a very clear, undeniable picture that a highly functional, stable replicin is the absolute biological bottleneck for human growth.
If we connect this back to the living children in group 3 with extreme growth retardation, it sounds like this continuous replicative stress basically causes a sort of intra-rotorin programming. The cellular struggle to copy DNA forces the entire developing organism to scale down its body size just to survive.
Because every single cell cycle takes significantly longer, and because so many cells inevitably die from accumulating DNA damage along the way, the total number of healthy cells generated during embryonic and fetal development is drastically reduced.
Wow.
The organism survives thanks to the hycomorphic nature of the variant allowing 15% function, but it programs itself to grow to a fraction of the normal size. The microscopic stress strictly dictates the macroscopic form.
It brings us right back to where we started. That tiny wobble in the scaffolding changes the entire architecture of the building, determining exactly how tall it's allowed to grow. To distill everything we've covered today, biallelic hypomorphic variants in the WDHD1 gene disrupt the crucial replicin scaffolding, causing severe replicative stress that stunts human development and causes microcephalic primordial dwarfism.
What does this mean for our broader understanding of how microscopic cellular stress dictates the limits of human growth?
This episode was based on an open access article under the CC BY 4.0 license. You can find a direct link to the paper and the license in our episode description. If you enjoyed this, follow or subscribe in your podcast app and leave a 5-star rating. If you'd like to support our work, use the donation link in the description. Now stay with us for an original track created especially for this episode and inspired by the article you've just heard about. Thanks for listening, and join us next time as we explore more science, base by base.
Small hands reach for a morning that won't wait. Quiet rooms, bright screens, counting every break in the code of life. A letter slips its place, and time runs thin on a fragile kind of pace. Threads are copying, start to drag and fray. A stutter in the steps from night to day. Can read the pattern through the noise. Name the reason, give it back a voice. Hold the fork, hold the line, don't let it burn. When the road of DNA won't twist, won't turn. If the splice cuts wrong, we stitch what we can see. From the smallest star to a wide open key. lay like highways under lab-like glow. Slow recovery when the pressure hits the flow. Signals flare where the strands can't stay in tune. Sister ties come undone too soon, too soon. Not a total blackout, there's a flicker left inside. A hypomorphic heartbeat in the machinery stride. So we trace each variant, follow where it leads. For the families in the hallways, praying for a seed. Hold the fork, hold the line, don't let it burn.